This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a pleasure for me to have in the studio David Harvey, a Marxist anthropologist at the City University of New York and the author of many books, including his latest, which we're going to talk about today. It's called The Enigma of Capital and the Crises of Capitalism. David Harvey, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
What is the enigma of capital?
The enigma is how on earth does a system that is, in effect, so irrational manage to reproduce itself time after time after time? Why is it so crisis prone? And actually, the enigma is, how does it use crises to sort of reemerge out of the ashes of its own making into a new phoenix-like construct?
Well, it is kind of magical, and it's an urgent question because we're in one of these crises, a big crisis, the likes of which we haven't seen for, a lot of people say, the Great Depression, and I think that's a credible case. There have been other hard recessions, but this one's particularly brutal. So how does it keep surviving?
I want to backtrack a little bit. It's brutal here, but in China, it's growing at nearly 10% again. And in many parts of the world, people will look at you and say, what crisis? So it's a bit like Argentina went through a crisis in 2001, 2002, or Indonesia went through one in 1998. Actually, we notice the crisis is focused here. And, of course, the big focus of the crisis here is unemployment. In effect, what we're beginning to see is the way in which political power is using the crisis to try to create a different kind of universe, mainly through a politics of austerity. In other words, what we've done is we've shifted from a financial crisis of the banks to saying there's a financial crisis of state expenditures. And the only way to resolve that is you people have to give way on your services and everything else. So they're now trying to shift the cost of the crisis onto the mass of the population, which, by the way, they've been doing for a very long time now. Back in the 1980s, that's what they did in Mexico and everywhere else.
And even as the top 1% has seen its income grow, I saw one figure, 399% over the last 15 years or 18 years. So they're not the ones who are sacrificing.
No, they're having a good time. They're having a good time. And there's this great quote from, I guess it was Andrew Mellon, the banker who became Secretary of the Treasury, who said, in a crisis, assets return to their rightful owners, i.e. him.
Him and his few buddies.
Yes.
And who was the Secretary of Treasury during the early part of the Depression who said, liquidate everything, liquidate the farms, liquidate the factories? I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember who that was.
But it was the same kind of idea, and he'll gain from the liquidation.
I know that the Secretary of the Treasury, when the New York fiscal crisis in 1975, said, we should just sell it to the Shah of Iran, the whole of New York City.
That would have been lovely, too.
Yes.
The odd thing about this current push to socialize the costs of the crisis and make the mass of people in the United States and in Europe, for that matter, take the punishment. The oddity of that is it's irrational from capitalism's own perspective, or my interpretation of what its perspective is, because if what we have here is a crisis of demand, there's not enough people with enough money to buy the goods that the producers are producing, then making people take pay cuts is going to make that even worse.
Yeah, and putting even more people out of the jobs, and austerity is about taking on the public sector unions and probably firing a lot of people from the public sector. The British are now doing this. The latest estimates are that the policies of the British government are going to create 1.6 million more people unemployed. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of ask yourself the question, where is the demand going to come from?
I mean, this in the beginning of the Depression, the leaders of industry and of government were saying workers should take a cut. They thought that that was going to be the way. But why this demand from the powers that run the capitalist system that the mass of people should be more unemployed and get lower wages?
You know, I think part of the problem right now is that the powers that are running it are not really thinking about their own collective interests. As I see it, you know, the capitalist class, if one can call it that, has always had a problem of articulating its class interest as opposed to its individual interest. And right now, it seems to me you've got a bunch of individual interests out there and a bunch of factional interests. So the financiers are a faction, a very powerful one, and the individuals out there are saying, I just want a world that is going to be good for me. And as a result of that, you're getting this politics of après moi le déluge, let the floods come after I've made my buck. And I don't think there's anywhere in the capitalist world right now where a capitalist class interest is being very well articulated by political power. So they're just doing what they're doing for themselves, and that's it.
Certainly not a long-term or visionary one, or one that would be interested in preserving the entire system, kind of a David Rockefeller type approach.
Right.
I'm speaking with David Harvey. He's a Marxist anthropologist at the City University of New York. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. This is Progressive Radio. And this is baffling to me. I recall Noam Chomsky saying about class consciousness in the United States, there isn't a lot of class consciousness except at the very top, that the business class is very conscious. The super rich are very conscious. And yet they're not running the show in a way that makes sense. And maybe they're eating their own propaganda, if you will.
Well, some of them, I think, have a sort of perspective. I mean, I was very impressed when Warren Buffett was asked about, is there class struggle? And he said, yeah, of course there's class struggle, and it's my class, the rich class, that's waging it, and we're winning. So there are some people who are aware, and you can, I don't know, listen to the Buffetts of this world or the George Soroses of this world, and at least some of them are aware, but I think they're in a minority compared to what everybody else is doing.
Well, and then you have the Rand Pauls who say, we have no classes. There is no rich, there
right.
is no middle class, there is no poor.
Yes, well, that's a very comforting vision, which has been part of the ideology of the United States all along. You know, the Rockefellers didn't really exist, and they didn't really exercise all the power that they exercised.
And the 1% doesn't hold 24%
right.
of the income or
right.
35% of the wealth or whatever right. it is, a ridiculous amount, which has just grown astronomically.
Yes, absolutely. Over the last 30 years, it's the inequality has surged all over the place.
David Harvey, let me take you, why don't you take me and take the listener in his car or her office or their home, about how you see this spinning out right now as far as the crisis here in the United States and in Europe.
I think it's gone from being a foundational economic question, which it seems to me it was 2 years ago when the asset market in housing in particular went bust and you had then a financial crisis. It's gone from that into a political arena as to how the political crisis is going to be used and by which faction and in what direction. And the world is bifurcated right now into Europe and North America, where it's going to be used politically by the right wing to demolish what is left of the welfare state and to demolish, if you like, the responsibility of government for social reproduction, for health care, and all those other kinds of things. So it's going to be used politically in that way, which is going to have disastrous economic consequences for reasons we've already mentioned. Now, the other half of the world, which is really oriented around China, is really saying we have to use deficit financing to create a huge number of jobs with infrastructural projects like building the new rail system in China, building the new highway system, building new cities, all this kind of thing, building new green technologies and all the rest of it. And China, of course, is growing at 10% a year. And anybody who's oriented to the China trade is doing okay. Australia, for example, supplies a lot of raw materials to China. There's been no depression in Australia. Most of Latin America has now been turned into a vast soybean plantation supplying the China market. And Brazil is growing at the rate of 6% a year. Even Argentina, that 10 years ago was a basket case, is growing at 7 or 8% a year. So anybody who's in that kind of corner of things is doing okay. And they're the ones who look at you and say, what crisis? Now, they're using it politically to actually develop their own power. So we're going to see strong growth in that area, unless, of course, the China model blows up, and there are some suspicions it may do so because there can be overinvestment there. But in North America and Europe, we're going to see a long period of stagnation. We're going to see the 7 million people who have lost their jobs, net loss of jobs in this country, are not going to get them back. Long-term unemployment in this country, which never got above 25% of the unemployed, is now at 50% of the unemployed. We are in a new terrain in this country, and this country is I'm almost prepared to say it's committing economic suicide by the political decisions that it's making, but it's making those political decisions in such a way as to benefit one class faction and bunches of individuals rather than to take care of the whole kind of capitalist system.
Speaking with David Harvey, anthropologist at the City University of New York, author of The Enigma of Capital and the Crises of Capitalism. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. China, you just mentioned. At what point can China just tell the United States to kiss off? And I don't mean so much the bonds, which everyone talks about. But if China, really builds up its own internal gigantic market, it's not going to need to sell its goods to the United States.
Well, I think you're beginning to see. I saw some data recently suggested China is not investing in U.S. bonds so much anymore. And the reason that people are investing in bonds is that to the degree that people in the United States are saving, they're putting them into bonds. So the bond market is where it is, not because of China's investments, but because of U.S. domestic investment.
And also, there is a lot of just xenophobia against China because Japan is a big holder of those bonds, too.
Yes, absolutely.
And other countries in the Gulf states, as you point out, they're big holders.
But you can also see that China is already kind of saying to the United States, you say we should revalue, we're not going to do it. And by the way, when you did this quantitative easing recently, you were in effect devaluing the dollar, and you pretend you don't manipulate your currencies when you do. So I think China is not going to be pushed around on any of this.
The quantitative easing that Ben Bernanke did, I try to study this stuff, and I just can't understand it. So if you could explain it to me. I know they're essentially putting, billions of more dollars into the economy, but how does it work? How does it work?
Well, they basically use Federal Reserve money to buy up Treasury bonds, and then they just store them in the Federal Reserve.
And why is that helpful to the economy?
Well, then the $600 billion or whatever it is that goes out there is then useful in the economy in general. So it's like releasing a flood of money into the economy. And, of course, the naysayers say they're just going to create inflation down the way. But you're going to have a surplus of dollars, and the hope is that somebody somewhere will spend them.
Or start lending them.
Will lend them and to somebody who will then use them and then sell to somebody who has the money to buy. But if nobody has the money to buy, it seems to me it's a fool's errand.
Well, it is a fool's errand, and this is the thing that astonished me about the bank bailout, $700, $800 billion to the bank and literally trillions of dollars in guarantees. If they just gave every citizen of the United States, their prorated share of that $700 billion, that would have goosed the economy in a real positive direction.
And you could have solved the foreclosure problem by, in effect, having the state go in. And if you, early on, you had picked up all of the foreclosures and said, all right, we're going to sort of socialize this, nationalize it, if you will, then there would be no financial crisis. They could have started at that end. But that would have meant bailing people out rather than bailing the banks out. And that is not a principle which the government likes to adhere to.
And Timothy Geithner, Treasury Secretary, said when he was asked about nationalizing, because even Alan Greenspan toyed with the idea that we should nationalize Bank of America and Citibank at one point, and he said, no, my job here is to preserve the private financial system of the United States, which was honest enough, but grotesque if you look at it, because he's a secretary in the cabinet of a Democratic administration, which was put into power so that it could get people jobs and save the economy, but he wanted to preserve the jobs of the CEOs of the banks.
Well, but there was also, however, a choice about the way you did it. You didn't have to do it by directly bailing out the banks. You could have done it by bailing out the homeowners. I mean,
and I've said this before, I mean, Obama could have said, and Geithner could have said, you guys want the money, okay, take the money, but you can't foreclose on anybody.
Well, that's effectively the same.
Yeah, I mean, they held, the banks that were bailed out held something like 85% of this country's mortgages.
Yeah, no, they could have, there were various ways they could have done it, and they didn't choose to.
And why didn't they choose to? I think
political power, we've mentioned already that over the last 30 years, income inequality has grown immensely. You look at the way the Bush tax cuts were oriented, it was all to the benefit of the ultra-rich. And we've had government in power over the last 20, 30 years that, in a sense, has leaned always that way and has never leaned in the direction of saying, really bail out the poor people rather than the rich. So it's busy bailing out the rich, and that's its gut reaction almost now is to bail the rich out first and then worry about the poor later. But, of course, you don't worry about the poor at all eventually.
But the amazing thing here in the United States, which is really in the throes of a kind of primitive capitalism and primitive capitalist ideology almost, is that as this has been going on, and it's been obvious to a lot of people, the banks made out like bandits and the 1% are doing extraordinarily well and the rest aren't. But the ideology of the free market, at least with the recent elections, seemed to reign supreme.
I don't think we really have a free market at all. There's a wonderful expression which I like, which is there's nothing more unequal than the equal treatment of unequals. And what the free market does, insofar as it comes into being, is it starts to exert that principle. So if you are endowed with a lot of assets at the beginning, you end up with much more at the end, and the poor people get poorer. That's the logic of how the market works. Now, that means it's not really free, in the sense that it's based on the notion of equality between people at all. It's always been based on inequality and scarcities, which are manipulated by people. And you can see that right now with things like speculation in commodities, speculation in land, speculation on housing prices and so on. So the speculators gain. But that is a kind of market too, but it's nothing whatsoever to do with freedom.
And David Harvey, in your book, you posit that the way that capitalism survives and survived in the last couple decades is one bubble after another, and you question whether it can continue this way because you don't think it's running out of places to invest its surplus, is the way you put it.
I'd be very concerned, kind of saying, historically capitalism has grown about 2.25% per year since around 1750. It's a compound rate of growth. And all of the financial observers you'll see in the press and everywhere would say the minimum rate of growth is around 3%. Above that, things start to be good, and China, of course, going at 10%, so that's great. So there's a sort of growth syndrome. And that growth syndrome is becoming more and more stressful. Right now, a 3% compound rate of growth over the next 20 or 30 years means that by the time you get to 2030, you need something like $3 trillion of new profitable investment opportunities to open up. And if you look back, you kind of say, actually, capital was having difficulty finding new profitable investment opportunities in the 1980s, and so it started to create these speculative bubbles. Stock market, the new economy, the sort of electronic world, eBay and all of those kinds of things. And then, of course, it switched into the housing market. And the art market's another one. And, of course, we've got all of these futures markets and derivatives markets and all those other things that nobody understands how they work. So, in effect, you were creating fictitious markets. And then people were making a lot of money and accessing a lot of power out of those fictitious markets. So I think we're at an inflection point in the history of capitalism where the real question is, where is the possibility of real expansion on a 3% compound growth path minimum?
Well, what about Africa?
Well, Africa's a space, yeah. It's still reasonably empty. But on the other hand, 30 years ago, China was not in it, but now it's in it big time. And so very quickly it got absorbed into it big time. Russia was not in it in the same way it now is. And so actually we've seen these new spaces suddenly integrated into the global economy very quickly. And the quicker they get integrated and the more powerful they become, the more serious this compound growth issue becomes.
Because there are fewer places.
There are fewer places to go. And Africa is one place to go. And it's interesting. The Chinese, for example, are buying up vast amounts of land and resources in Africa. Actually, people from the United States are similarly buying up in Latin America and elsewhere. So there's a land grab going on worldwide to try and control the global resources. So again, that's another asset bubble which is beginning to form.
You mentioned egalitarianism and inequality a few minutes ago, David Harvey, and you talk a lot about, in your book, The Enigma of Capital and the Crises of Capitalism, this radical egalitarianism, which is something that you propound. How do you define it?
I think it's a situation in which we, all of us, have equal chances at a background of socializing risk. I mean, we socialize risk for the banks, so why don't we socialize it for everybody? We all have equal chances, but we should never fall below a certain minimum standard of living. There should be a minimum payment, if you like, to everybody. I mean, I think that every kid that's born should be given an endowment when they're born and allowed then to tap into that endowment when they're 20 years old or something of that kind. So you could imagine a world that had a radical equality in the sense that nobody was going to fall out into abject poverty. We would all have, I mean, if you like, a certain standard of living, but there would be the possibility of advancement above that in various dimensions.
And you say in this book, that might sound utopian, but we, what choice do we have? We need to be utopian. And yet there are dangers of utopianism, too. I interviewed Margaret Atwood, the great novelist, and she's kind of a dystopian, anti-utopian, and she thinks chasing after utopias lands you in the killing fields.
I had, one of my former books, I actually did a lot of work on the utopian stuff, and one of the problems with them is that most utopias are defined as static systems. And it's interesting, they're usually given a very spatial form. It's a planned community of some kind in which nothing new happens. And my point about that was that doesn't seem very utopian to me, that actually what you need is to imagine a society in which new things can happen, and therefore you start to – I have a more kind of what I call a dialectical process-based utopia that is constantly revolutionizing, constantly changing.
But, of course, people will point to not just Pol Pot but Stalin and –
Yeah, but they were about trying to freeze history. They were not trying to liberate it. And my point here is to kind of say, if you start to see it as a dynamic process as opposed to essentially all utopias are very conservative and authoritarian in the end, which is why I think Margaret Atwood is right, to be suspicious of the normal kind of thinking about utopias. But I'm trying to invent, if you like, a dynamic utopia, which is constantly changing. And you find that in some thinkers when they start to talk about permanent revolution. Jefferson, for example, talked about the necessity of a permanently revolutionary society. And I think he understood very well, even though he had his own particular vision of the perfect society in the United States, that a revolutionary transformation every now and again was going to be very important. So that I think this notion of a permanently revolutionary utopian ideal is, to me, actually very much the way in which I would sort of implement or go towards thinking about a utopian situation.
I'm speaking with David Harvey. He's the author of The Enigma of Capital and the Crises of Capitalism. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and this is Progressive Radio. It just seems so far away here in the United States. I mean, I would think if you're in Bolivia or in Venezuela or in Ecuador, it might be something more easy to grab, more easily grabbed onto. But here in the U.S., it seems so remote, and you write in your book, a lot depends on whether the mass of the population rises up. That is one of the oddities here in the United States, where we have near record levels of unemployment unseen in 70 years, and yet the streets aren't filled with the unemployed rebelling. We have record levels of home foreclosures, and the foreclosed upon aren't in the streets.
It's a mystery to me too. This is a part of the enigma of capital. How do we exist in a society where the system can do this to you, and you not say we have to change the system? One of the things, however, I have learned is that a lot of people, for example, who've been foreclosed upon, actually blame themselves. And we've been taught, I think, over the last 30 years, a notion of personal responsibility. So we tend to blame ourselves when something goes wrong instead of saying it's the system, not me.
There's a great book, The Hidden History of Class, that talks about that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we need, therefore, to sort of come back and kind of say, well, yeah, okay, to what degree is it my fault and to what degree does it have systemic roots? And if it has systemic roots, then maybe we should change the system.
And how do you see that happening here in the U.S.? Can you conceive of that happening?
Well, it partly comes back to the imaginary and to the utopia and having a different idea of what might be possible. I mean, it was a very interesting, you know, talking about my ideas of a dynamic version of utopia. I was talking with some theologians once, and the theologian said, "Well, you know, the big problem with the Christian definition of paradise is that it's so static that they can well understand why nobody wants to go there. And therefore, why not think about paradise as a place which is, you know, permanently changing and therefore is constantly stimulating you to new ideas, new things?" And I think this is something we forget about human beings, that they are perpetually interested in the pursuit of novelty and newness. And we see the way capital has used that to sort of get us the last latest,
sell products.
But what we have to do is we have to sell a transformative process, which is about that, and try to mobilize that passion for novelty and that passion for newness. And you will see this, by the way, in some of the experiments going on, like, slow foods, local foods, there are lots of things going on, actually, which are actually talking about a different kind of sociality and a different kind of society. And I guess my imagination is that one day they'll all come together and say, we don't need capitalism anymore.
And they are anti-market ideas. The farmer's market, the organic slow food movement, as you said.
Yeah, right.
For a Marxist, David Harvey, you give a lot of power to ideas, just as you're saying, talking about the Christian idea of paradise, which I think is one reason why it's such a popular story. At least they get to go somewhere at the end. But.
Yeah.
Why do you stress, because some crude Marxists would just say it's all from the economy?
No, I think, Marx, of course, once said, "I am not a Marxist." And I understand very well why. Because sometimes ideas were attributed to him that he didn't hold. And one of the ideas, I think, that is attributed to him is that ideas don't matter. In fact, he argued very explicitly that ideas are a material force in history. And there's an ideal moment, and he talks about what separates the worst of architects from the best of bees is this, that the architect erects a structure in imagination before building it upon the ground. So the imagination is there in Marx, the ideas are there in Marx. Where the materialism comes in is these don't really mean very much unless they're actually transformed into practical activity on the ground. And with that, I concur. So you've got to make the material. The architect can have a dream house, but until they actually make it and then find out what's wrong in living in it, then they realize, that they have to dream in a different kind of way. So to me, ideas are a very important and powerful material force, but they have to be connected with practices and with effects on daily life where people can actually say, well, that was a good idea.
David Harvey's been my guest today. He's the author of The Enigma of Capital and the Crises of Capitalism. And that practice need not happen, you say in your book, at the shop floor necessarily or at the point of production. It can happen at a lot of different places. And I wish we had more time to talk about that. People should go pick up your book, The Enigma of Capital and the Crises of Capitalism, and find out more about that. David Harvey, thanks so much for being
my guest. Well, thank you for having me. It's been great.
My pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.